City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
The automated voice on my machine says, mailbox full, please call again. Or the message is, hi honey, have you disappeared? You Scorpios are really weird. Maybe that's why I can't shake the funk I'm in. I think the only thing that's keeping me alive is a good cup of coffee and songs in the key of life. But I know, hey, 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 everything's gonna be all.
And you're listening to the Windy City Queercast, show number 509. I'm Amy Matheny, and goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I'm pretty excited. I am sitting down for a really long chat on a cold day in Chicago with Tony Award winner and amazing singer-songwriter and fellow Tennessean, Levi Kreiss, on the show today. And it's going to be fantastic. You're going to hear so many Southern accents and references, you're not going to know what to do. It's just more Southernness than you can shake a stick at. So Levi and I are here in Chicago, his new home. He is now a Chicagoan, and he's got a new CD coming out just in time for Pride, a CD single, which you're going to hear on our show, So Much Better, that is going to be released on March 4th, and a new tour launching here in Chicago and heading hopefully to a city near you if you're listening not from the Chicago area. I'm so excited. Levi's here.
Glamour, romance, and sensuality. See the Joffrey Ballet in American Legends. Jerome Robbins' Interplay conveys the wonderful playfulness and unfettered curiosity of youth. Gerald Arpino's lush duet Sea Shadow honors the 90th anniversary of his birth. The voice of Frank Sinatra sets you swinging in Twyla Tharp's classic Nine Sinatra Songs, costumed by Oscar de la Renta. Stanton Welch's exuberant and theatrical Son of Chambers Symphony makes its Chicago premiere. It's the Joffrey Ballet in American Legends at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, now through February 24th. For tickets, call 800-982-2787 or visit joffrey.org.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Weekend News.
HRC has announced its endorsement of Lesbian City Council Speaker Christine Quinn for mayor of New York City. HRC President Chad Griffin said that Quinn approaches every issue she cares about with passion and drive, whether it's equality for all New Yorkers, great public schools, or 21st century infrastructure. Chris is ready to fight for the city New Yorkers deserve.
Virginia's lower house passed a bill that would allow student groups at public universities to deny members because they conflict with the group's religious beliefs. LGBT leaders in the state believe the bill, which passed by an 80-19 vote, will give student groups a free pass to deny and boot gay and transgender members.
President Obama has nominated Todd M. Hughes for a seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals of the Federal Circuit. Hughes will be the first openly gay federal appellate court judge. The White House stated that Hughes is a deputy director of the Commercial Litigation Branch of the Civil Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, a position he has held since 2007. He has also served as an adjunct lecturer in law with the Cleveland Marshall College of Law and as an instructor for Duke University's writing program.
Orlando, Florida-based Walt Disney World has welcomed its first openly gay president. On February 1st, George Kalogridis became Disney World's fifth president after having served as president of California's Disneyland since 2009. Kalogridis, who is 59, has been with the Walt Disney Company since 1971 when he landed a job bussing tables at Disney's Contemporary Resort.
In Oregon, Gresham baker Aaron Klein is being investigated for allegedly refusing to make a wedding cake for a lesbian couple. The women said that Klein, who owns Sweet Cakes Bakery, called them abominations to the Lord. Klein denies saying that, but admits that he wouldn't make the cake. An Oregon law bans sexual orientation discrimination in public accommodations, including businesses. However, critics argue that the ban could conflict with Klein's constitutional right to practice his religion.
Could a gay Republican be the next mayor of Los Angeles? Kevin James, who is not the King of Queens actor, is hoping to be the one for the job. James said, depending on what room you're in, sometimes it's easier coming out gay to Republicans than it is coming out Republican to gays. A former prosecutor and current radio talk show host, James has raised about $700,000 for his mayoral bid.
Arizona legislator Lila Alston introduced a bill that would make it a felony to intentionally expose someone to HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. Alston, a Democrat in Arizona's House of Representatives, was inspired to introduce the bill after a constituent described to her how she was unknowingly affected with an STD. The legislation, referred to a judicial committee, is already gaining sponsors.
North Dakota lawmakers are considering a bill that would prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation in housing, government, public services, and the workplace. The measure would amend the North Dakota Fair Housing Act and the North Dakota Human Rights Act. It is sponsored by a group of lawmakers that includes State Representative Josh Boshi, the state's first openly gay legislator.
A new study has found the more straight men watch pornography, the more likely they are to back marriage equality. Scientists believe the reason is porn opens up the mind to accepting non-traditional sexual situations like male-on-male sex.
Florida's Lake County School Board could create new rules that would keep a local gay-straight alliance from forming in a middle school. The school board discussed the rules for student clubs at a workshop, with most members saying they want to limit extracurricular student groups in secondary schools. The discussion came after the ACLU supported 14-year-old Bailey Silberstein, who wanted to form an alliance at Carver Middle School in Leesburg. Silberstein was denied last school year, but reapplied to form the group in October.
U.S. District Judge John Corbett O'Mara sentenced Detroit resident Everett Dwayne Avery, age 26, to 18 months in prison to be followed by 3 years of supervised release after Avery pled guilty to committing a hate crime by assaulting a man because the man was gay. In 2011, Avery used anti-gay slurs and punched the victim in the face, fracturing the victim's eye socket. Avery pled guilty to violating the Federal Hate Crimes Protection Act on August 29, 2012.
In world news, Guido Westerwelle, Germany's openly gay foreign minister, reportedly told Moscow's envoy to Berlin, Vladimir Grinin, that a Russian draft law banning homosexual propaganda could harm Russia's ties with Europe. Westerwelle had made clear that in Germany's view, the law violated the European Human Rights Convention. Westerwelle told Grinin he spoke as a friend of Russia who wanted Moscow to better defend human rights and democracy.
In England, the trial of Dale Cregan, a one-eyed suspect accused of killing lesbian police officer Fiona Bone and another cop, has begun. Cregan is accused of luring the two female police officers to a false robbery, shooting them until he had run out of bullets and then throwing a grenade toward them. Before her death, Bone was engaged in planning her civil partnership with girlfriend Claire.
In Wales, a transgender woman accused of raping a woman after showing her around an S&M dungeon has insisted to a jury she did nothing wrong. In addition, Nadine Natasha Williams, formerly Dean Williams, denied wanting sex with the woman as a last throw of the dice before finally becoming a woman herself. Williams said the complainant had wanted sex and had asked to be shown the S&M room known as the dungeon.
Italian region Puglia's governor, Nici Vendola, has said that life in Rome is too dangerous for gays and lesbians. Vendola, who has been openly gay since he was 18, said, "I fear going out alone at night in Rome." Rome Mayor Gianni Alemano responded, "My city has the same problems of all European big cities. Vendola should think about his own city, Bari, which is not better than Rome."
And in entertainment news, the movie Argo continued its awards roll as Ben Affleck won top film honors from the Directors Guild of America for his CIA thriller about the Iran hostage crisis. The film has won virtually every major film award since Affleck was snubbed for a Best Director nomination when the Oscars nominees were announced January 10th. Only three films have won Best Picture at Oscars without being nominated for Best Director in 84 years. Most recently, 1989 winner Driving Miss Daisy. The Oscars will air February 24th.
Out actor Sir Ian McKellen received an honorary doctorate degree from the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland. The actor was given the Doctor of Letters degree by the university's chancellor, Dr. James Nesbitt. "Thanks to every gay person in public and non-public life who has come out," McKellen said in his speech.
Openly gay film director Bryan Singer, of The Usual Suspects and X-Men fame, is donating $5 million to the USC School of Cinematic Arts. The school will name its Critical Studies Division the Bryan Singer Division of Critical Studies. Singer earned a bachelor's degree from the school in 1989.
Reuben Singer was thrust into the limelight on February 3rd. He's the designer behind Beyoncé's Super Bowl halftime show. Singer, age 34, designed the singer's outfit, a python, iguana, and chantilly lace black leotard, leather-cropped motorcycle jacket, and liquid nylon miniskirt.
Frameline, the nation's only nonprofit organization solely dedicated to the funding, exhibition, distribution, and promotion of LGBTQ media arts, has announced the recipients of its annual Frameline Completion Fund. Among the recipients are the Greg Louganis documentary Back on Board, Visible Silence, which focuses on gender variance, Thai women, the bullying documentary The Infamous T, Valencia, a narrative about queer women in San Francisco, and The Battle of Amphar, which looks at Elizabeth Taylor and research scientist Dr. Matilda Krim.
Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks is releasing her debut solo album called Mother on May 7th from Columbia Records. Fans of the country singer can expect something a little different this time around. Maines' sound is more rock-based. The title track is a Pink Floyd cover. Maines teamed with friend and Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Ben Harper, who co-produced the record with Maines.
Actor John Kerr, a Tony winner and the star of such films as Tea and Sympathy, as well as South Pacific, died at the age of 81. Kerr won a Tony for his role as a sensitive, effeminate schoolboy in the Robert Anderson play Tea and Sympathy, and starred with Deborah Kerr, no relation, in the 1956 film version. And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
Hello, everybody. This is Cherry Jones, and you are listening to the Windy City Queercast.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Queer.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of February 18th, 2013, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Don't miss the Writers Theater production of Sweet Charity, scored for a live jazz combo. The Chicago Sun-Times calls this classic dance musical a knockout, while New City raves Sweet Charity is full-blooded, euphoric, soulful, and no-holds-barred fantastic. The Chicago Tribune calls star Tiffany Topol astoundingly infectious and adds, Sweet Charity lights up the stage. For tickets, visit writerstheater.org.
Goodman Theater presents Teddy Ferrara, a gripping new drama by Christopher Shin. It's Gabe's senior year of college and his future looks bright. He runs the queer students group and he recently started dating a great guy. But when a campus tragedy occurs, it ignites a firestorm and throws Gabe's world into disorder. Get your tickets today at goodmantheater.org. Teddy Ferrara is running now at the Goodman through March 3rd.
Chicago Shakespeare Theater's unforgettable season continues with Julius Caesar, Shakespeare's epic tale of ambition, betrayal, and consequence. Don't miss the most enduring political thriller in history, now playing through March 24th. Visit ChicagoShakes.com for info and tickets to Julius Caesar. And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Hello, Deb Pierce here, letting you know that we'd love to hear back from you. So go ahead. You know you want to. Post a comment.
Ooh, roll the time down. Let's take an afternoon drive. See, I've been working too hard and I wanna leave it all behind. Behind me. Pushing and pulling, yeah, the world keeps spinning around. And around. And around. But I go with the flow, ain't nobody gonna get me down. Oh, no, no. You see, I'll tell you a little secret about the way that love's gonna be. It's a super sexy conscious cosmological ecstasy. It's getting hard on me. So much better, so much better now. Baby love, don't you know that it's so much better, so.
The Tony Award winning star of the Chicago turned Broadway rock and roll smash Million Dollar Quartet, Levi Kreiss, is my guest today. An Out Music Award winner, Levi's music has been featured on many network television shows on NBC, CBS, FX, CW. He's appeared on The View, David Letterman, Jimmy Fallon, and now he's launching a tour called The Flying Solo Tour and releasing his first new single from his new CD, Imagine Paradise. And the coolest thing is that I'm on the couch with Levi. Like, you're here in Chicago.
I think it's so cool that you're sitting in my abode.
I'm sitting in your abode. And you're lovely. Track lighting on a snowy Chicago day.
Oh, no, it's so gay.
It's so gay. It's so fabulous. And I, what an opportunity. So you're here now.
Yes. I call Chicago home.
You call. So you're a Chicagoan.
I am Chicagoan.
You're and a Southerner.
I hope that they'll
Chicago.
Have me and wait long enough for my Southern accent to subside.
No, don't
a little
get rid so of it. Can, there's okay. lots of us Southerners here. You
I know.
Know?
We're I'm glad that you're a Tennessee gal here
I
in
know.
Chicago. For how many years have you been here?
Oh my gosh. I'm going on. This is where I start defying my age. Oh. I was 10 when I moved here. I've been here 18 years.
Oh, wow.
Teasing.
Okay.
I've been here a long time.
Okay.
18 years.
Okay.
Though. Yeah. I think it's 18.
I love it. I feel
I
like
love it
moving
too.
From Los Angeles to Chicago has afforded me a sense of community that I don't know that I was able to really access in LA. Now, granted, I moved to Los Angeles with some incredible people from Tennessee.
Yep.
And we all kind of loaded up the truck, my little
and
Buick
moved
actually, and moved to Beverly. But, you know, it all becomes about the business there
yeah.
very quickly. And a lot of conversations that you have never really sort of venture outside of that.
Yeah.
And I started, I think that I'm getting into that period of my life where community and like conversation that doesn't have to do with the business is
yeah.
it's actually becoming more and more important to me. I want to find long-term friends that we can sit for days and never talk about what we're promoting.
Yeah. I mean, it's right. You know, when I was thinking of moving here, you know, the option was move to New York, move to LA, right?
Yeah.
Because I was acting and singing and not dancing much anymore, but my background was there. And, you know, and so I just remembered thinking that I wanted to be in an artistic community where there was great art accessible and people who valued that and loved to go and support art, and there was a rich cultural community. But I didn't want somebody to always ask me what show I was doing next or, you know, or like, what do you do? What are you working on?
Exactly.
Like, who are you? I would rather people ask me that question. Like,
yes.
Who are you today? Because
yes.
I might be different today than I was 10 days
ago. And we
ago.
Always are.
Right?
You know, I'm different than I was last year. But I'm getting to the place where I hop on that question, what do you do, with such...
Yeah.
You know, try to find the most dry, satirical answer I could possibly can.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I mean, let it be a surprise when Levi is your friend and you've just met him because y'all are just talking about... whatever, you know, something random.
Yeah.
And then, like, one day you know that he can play piano magically and sing magically. And
but, you know, the truth is a job is a job is a job. And we all have a point of service
right.
in this world. And it's all of our jobs to just take pride in whatever that point of service is. And it's always different. It needs to be different to make the world a whole place.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
so it's
yeah.
really not that.
Yeah.
You know, I think entertainment becomes this... this elevated thing, and obviously the gossip shows like, you know, E.T. and stuff like that doesn't really do anything to level the perception at all. But it gets, you know.
Well, it is interesting because we just did a show about this last week or week before, where we were discussing Jodie Foster, you know, at the Golden Globes, and saying, you know, whatever you thought of it, she was making in a very smart way. So I think if you blinked or you didn't re-listen or reread her transcript, you missed it. But she was basically saying, I'm not a personality. I'm not an entertainer. I'm not a reality star.
Right.
I'm an actor. Mm-hmm. This is my art, and I've been doing it since I was three. I choose to do this art, and because I choose to do this art doesn't mean... It is what I do. It is the job I have had since I was three. It doesn't mean you have a right to my life, or that I'm not trying to sell something and then saying I want my privacy, which definitely we have those closeted stars who do that, but she's just trying to do her deal, you know, which I thought that message was important, because I think this generation doesn't know the difference between Kim Kardashian and Jodie Foster, except they probably think Jodie's more talented, but they don't understand any other distinction.
It's true. First of all, I can't imagine what it's like to be to have the experience of being a child star and navigate your way through Hollywood by the time since you're 3 years old.
And then have the Hinckley assassination, the years in college where you're probably coming out. I mean, most women really deal with that, I think, in college. Maybe men too, but, you know, or of our generations, I think, your younger generation than me, but nowadays I think it's happening sooner in high school, junior high, you know, elementary school. But
I think
it's different.
Profoundly different for the kids that are behind me. Like, you take these 20s, these kids in their 20s, and it's just like, I'm amazed at how assured and empowered they are with knowing that and being able to sort of move forward in their social circles in high school and be able to own who they are. I think it's brilliant. But I also think that that's probably truer for the metropolitan areas than it is for a lot of the hometown areas in Tennessee and Mississippi and other places, because, you know, working the Pride Festival, I have still, just when I think that the younger generation is really walking around fully empowered, you know, then I have a teenager that comes up to me after a Pride Festival and tells me he was on the point of suicide, and had he not, you know, been influenced by X, Y, or Z, he would have you know, not had the hope that maybe there's nothing wrong with him. So
the roots are still deep, right? The homophobic roots are still deep, not only within the mainstream world in America, but even deep within ourselves, I think. And I think we're all still working in that, and I think us, the older generation, you know, we need to grow faster almost than they are, so that those roots are getting, you know, made shallower, I guess. The insidious roots of homophobia within ourselves. Because I know, you know, I grew up in that. So I have, you know, 20 years of that before I came to the last 20, you know, of esteem, feeling esteemable for being gay. You know, and it's been a day-to-day process, a day at a time, an interview at a time, and a moment of activism at a time to be this Amy, you know?
It's true. I think I see a lot of my gay brothers go through adolescence when they're, like, fully grown men.
Yeah.
You know,
and
I think that's starting to change a little bit. I really have to say that I don't know that I kind of allowed myself to get out of my self-destructive, self-worthless loop of behavior until like 2009.
Right.
You know, which is not long ago.
Yeah.
I hope that is easier for the generation that's behind us.
I hope it is too. And we're having some heroic strides in that, and just some things I think that are seminally changing the playing field. Having a sitting president at the inauguration,
first president to ever mention it,
and it's mentioned multiple times, and you've got a gay poet for the first time reading a poem, and, you know, these things change the fabric of our identity. It just does, as a country, and it's exciting. I agree. So you're enjoying Chicago.
Loving Chicago.
Yeah, that's so good. We're so glad to claim you. And do you already have, like, your favorite, I don't know, your favorite restaurant, your favorite walk, your favorite...
I love the Lady Gregory's here.
Yeah.
I love that just basically any street that you go down here in Chicago, you're going to find these one-of-a-kind restaurants serving one-of-a-kind food. Mm-hmm. I mean, this place is so hard to be skinny in this place.
because there's so much good food.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's ridiculous. And you lived in Manhattan, so
I know. But you know, it's that was too hectic for me anyway. I would never venture out in Manhattan. Yeah. I would make sure to have groceries and if I didn't have to go to work or come back from work, I would never leave.
Yeah.
It's impossible to do that here because it's just such, it's like, you know, this like street's like a little movie set. You know? It's
Mitchell
just
and I call it our little gay Dickens village,
Andersonville.
It's just like the little Dickens village.
Yeah.
So you're also from Tennessee.
Oliver Springs, Tennessee.
Oliver Springs. That's near Nashville. Central?
Graduating class of 5 people.
There you go.
Valedictorian with a C average.
And is that Central? Tennessee?
That is east. That is about 25, 30 minutes from Dollywood.
Oh, okay.
So I'm
so
like,
you're
we're
Eastern.
In the Smoky Mountains.
Where I was.
Like in yeah. towards the bottom of the Smoky Mountains.
Okay.
You're on the other side of the bottom of the Smoky Mountains,
yeah.
more south.
Yeah, I'm in that south corner and you're in the middle, I guess, mm-hmm. right? So grew up on that border.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your road to music. I mean, how is that built? I mean, I can only imagine it was church.
I came home from kindergarten graduation at 6 years old playing Pomp and Circumstance by ear with both hands. I had my brother work the pedals. And that was literally my introduction for my mom and dad to rush over to the piano and say,
what the hey?
Let's get this kid lessons.
Yeah.
So I immediately started piano lessons.
So just by ear.
Your first
part on the road was just you heard it and you knew how to produce it.
Heard it and I could find it easily. And that's always, you know, it's a great benefit, but it also, when you understand the value of education, it becomes a bit of a challenge. And
yeah.
I could fake it until junior high, mm-hmm. where I could have all my piano teachers just say, can you play it once for me before I go? And they never
mm-hmm.
caught on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally, in seventh grade, got a teacher who introduced me to atonal music,
mm.
Bartok, and other composers, where there was just no possible way for my ear to grab a hold of a melody. Yeah, so it forced me.
A few chords that then you had to just figure out how to get from that chord
exactly.
to that chord.
Yeah. So that forced me to learn reading skills. But
was it a musical family that you had?
You know, my dad sings.
Uh-huh.
My dad sings, and my mom tries harder than anybody I've ever
had. You're such a sweet mama's boy.
She was the president of the Brenda Lee fan club growing
yep,
up, so she
yep.
loved good old rock and roll music. She's
yep.
really responsible for bringing the Jerry Lee Lewis 45s over to me and playing them when
oh.
I was a kid. You know, by the time I was 12 years old, I was already doing Great Balls of Fire full out.
Wow.
So it's very synchronistic, if that's the right use of
yeah.
the word,
yeah.
to find myself doing that later on.
Funny. So you tell me about you obviously ultimately won the Tony Award for playing Jerry Lee Lewis and
yeah.
Million Dollar Quartet, show that's still playing here in Chicago.
It won't die.
I won't die. I guess it's playing in New York too.
No, closed in New York, but they are on tour.
They're on tour. Okay,
yes.
And they're playing here.
So give a plug for the guys on tour.
There you go. They're hardworking, I know. What was the journey to becoming a part of that cast for you? Like how did you find, did they find you? Did you find them?
It was nothing more than, well, I had first, let me back up even further. I was working on a musical called One Red Flower
mm-hmm.
with,
in LA.
In LA.
Mm-hmm.
I was in LA. A wonderful director by the name of Paris Barkley.
Who's
basically more
openly
known,
gay African-American film, television and director.
Yeah. Yes. And he was putting together a musical based on the book Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam, which is a collection of letters from Vietnam veterans in their 1-year tour of duty back home to their wives, to their families, to their sons, daughters,
mm-hmm.
to the loved
mm-hmm.
ones. And it basically tells the story of the war through the eyes of the letters.
Oh, cool.
He created a remarkable piece based around 5 guys in their tour of duty. All the lyrics to the songs, all the book, everything was the letters.
Wow.
Put together in the most brilliant way to tell the story about these 5 guys. One of the most layered like characters I've ever had the opportunity
mm.
to create as an actor. I
mm.
loved it. And that went to Seattle, to Beverly, Mass at North Shore Music. We
mm-hmm.
started talking with theaters in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And just about the time there was interest happening with the show in New York, 9/11 happened.
Mm.
And it became quickly a piece that no one would touch
yeah.
because of the subject matter.
Yep.
Therefore,
yep.
it kind of slipped into obscurity. However, Ted Rawlings, who was one of the producers of Million Dollar Quartet, was also a producer for that show. And they knew I had a Southern accent. I'd played a Southern redneck in the in One Red Flower, and heard that I could play the piano a little bit, but never really saw me. And they were doing a reading. They had just gotten the script from Floyd Mutrix, and they were going to take a look at it and see, you know, see what they could do with it. And so they brought me in, and it was, for me, I was just grateful to be getting $50 so I could buy groceries. You know, I never had that idea of like, oh, I'm an originator. I didn't even know what that meant.
I
was just like,
you were doing a
reading.
You're
going to give me $50 to like sit around for a week
so
and act a script and play Jerry Lee Lewis, which I've been playing since I was 12. Yeah, let's do it. You know, I'm sick of ramen noodles. I'd like to be able to buy a burger. And that really was about as lofty as it was for me. You know, until we kept doing those readings here and there. And then we finally got it on stage at Village Theater in Seattle. Really took a look at it. And it was, you know, we've seen the potential of it. It just continued to grow until we got here to Chicago, which was the official opening of it.
This was a good city for this, for the show. I mean, it really, it really struck a chord here that then, I think, springboarded it right to New York. And how did that show change things for you? Being in something, as you said, you know, I was happy to get a reading. You're working on other, I mean, I know you, I'm sure you were doing other plays and projects, but you know, that's a long journey. You know, eight shows a week
since 2004.
To be working on a character, a show. I mean, how does that change you as an artist and just as a person to, you know, come back to something with that discipline, like year after year, as you head into like New York, you know, and the stage is kind of maybe getting bigger, and the did it feel like the stage was getting bigger, or that the, I don't know, the responsibility was getting bigger?
I kept fighting being an actor because I moved to LA to be a recording artist. I was going through, you know, I've gone through, then I'd be seen by Columbia Records, and that wouldn't work out, and Arista Records, and that wouldn't work out, A&M Records, do a demo deal, that didn't work out, think I'm getting signed to the Work Group when Fiona Apple's hot, that didn't work out, and I just run through them all. I didn't...
You wanted to be a recording artist, singer-songwriter?
I never wanted to write your own stuff? Yeah. It never occurred to me.
Right.
But I was, my first week in Los Angeles, I was laying on the sofa of a girlfriend of mine, saw a Backstage West, and thought, what's this? Looked at it and was like, oh, this is what those actors that get off the bus and want to become, you know, stars look at. And I said, well, this would be a very interesting way to spend my day in Los Angeles. I've only been here for a week. I don't have a picture or resume. I never considered myself an actor, but I'm going to go. I know what a cattle call is.
Right.
And there's this thing called rent. I was 169th in line. Five callbacks later, I was called for the role of Roger in the West Coast Tour.
Wow.
And it was one of those things that I never took seriously, but it's like music, the doors kept getting closed, but involuntarily the acting work kept coming to me. Because it wasn't until I walked away from Atlantic Records, came out, owned my story, and went to my community that I started to see all the TV licensing and the all the abundance come to me from a recording artist aspect. But you know, we're talking prior to that, acting never occurred to me. It was always the thing that showed up that allowed me to survive. And it never occurred to me how serious, how deep I was into it until I was told here in Chicago that we were going to New York. And then I was scared shitless. Because I'm like, holy shit.
Did you think I was like, you're a fraud? You're like, I'm a fraud.
I did. I absolutely
I can relate to that. Like, I'm a fraud. I've often felt like I'm a fraud in journalism, or I'm a fraud in radio, because I thought I was an actor. And, you know, then this is what I fell into.
How dare us have the nerve to step into that?
It's true.
It's true. Matter of fact, after the Tony Awards, I took the Tony Award and threw it in the back of the closet. I couldn't look at it. It made me nervous. I felt like a fraud. I didn't know why I was in this position, and it scared me. It absolutely scared me. And everyone else may have their own story about what that's like. But for me, you know, you think about, I get on the Broadway stage at the point where I'm, what, 11 months sober for the first time in my life. I'm now being you know, under critique by Tony voters. You know, when you're 10 months sober, I'm 10, 11 months sober, you're like on little fawn
nerve
legs.
Endings,
you
right?
know, it's not fun at all. I mean, you're a bag of insecurities and you're just hoping to get through the next day. So to be in that position was I was going through nervous breakdowns because I felt like all of a sudden my life was expanding at a pace that I wasn't equal to. But then a wonderful reverend told me, he says, things don't happen to you unless you're equal to them, because it's just simply the law of attraction. So you need to expand your consciousness to accept the fact
that you're that,
that you, that, that your life is expanding, you know,
that it's that big, that it's that possible, that it's that.
It's out of the closet now.
It is. So the Tony's out of the closet now. It's not sitting here to my right or my left.
You passed it coming up.
Oh, okay. I'll see it when I go back down. But like, so it's, so, you know, for a lot of people, it's like that impact, especially in that supporting category. You know, you hear it too with people who get it, you know, with Oscars or with Tonys or, you know, does it feel like, okay, well, then what else is there to kind of reach for? But you don't sound like you're one of those people who this was your goal, was to win a Tony Award, you know? So for you, it feels very right-sized. It was like an endorsement from your community, an endorsement from the universe to you, as you just eloquently said, and then that's its entire power. Does it have power and impact your career in terms of, does the phone start ringing for other shows like right after, and people want you to leave Million Dollar Quartet and come to us, or no?
I think that knowing other friends of mine who have been one of them an Oscar winner and a couple of them other Tony winners, the story's always the same. You know, people think that all of a sudden there's this big shift. I mean, the great thing about it is I'll be seen for any role now, which is great. It's always mine to win or lose. And people open your emails more often if you put the T word in the subject.
you
know, but like, other than that, really what is different is other people's story of what that is, you know, because it isn't what people I think would think, because it's, and for me it was just a big mirror in my face. I mean, I'm still only now getting to a point where I understand that the reason people like Paris Barclay and Ted Rawlings and the Tony voters are saying something about me as an actor is because I've been in absolute denial of the, of what who wrote the Seven Spiritual Laws. I'm trying to think of who wrote that.
I know what you're talking about.
But the law of least effort. When we have this idea of what our life's supposed to look like, and we're so stubborn about it that we don't stop to realize that perhaps the universe wants to use us in another way.
Yeah.
And we're not pliable in
and
that
so
sense.
You miss it. The lack of flexibility.
Yes.
You break. Yeah. I mean, you either that idea that you have, it's it's Promethean, right? You're just trying to push a boulder up a hill. I've always heard that, you know, if it's hard, it's probably not right or in the universe's plan. If it's easy, you just need to walk right on through, you know?
Not that it's not hard. I think the hardest part is to believe in myself.
Yeah.
And like, I did a reading in New York 2 weeks ago for this piece that it's like my favorite piece I've ever seen in my life. It has an incredible team up behind it. I'm so excited. I was in the room with like these other, like monumental Broadway people. And I'm sitting here like literally by Wednesday of a week of a reading, having a nervous breakdown, like guttural crying, because I'm asking myself, oh my God, don't they know I pulled the wool over their eyes the first time? And I'm just, how can I pull this off? Because it was like carrying a lead character of this, and all of the layers that's involved in spreading that through the entire piece was, you know, it turned out fantastic by the end of the week. But it was painful, because I think the journey for, and you know what, it's not just me, it's all of us. Anybody, any of us who are traveling that road to believing in the value and worth and the the power of who we are as individuals, we have to go, you know, birthing a baby is not a pleasant experience.
I hear tale
You know, and it's the same thing when we're going to birth anything new in our life. There is that constrictive, painstaking
experience that is not fun.
It's the caterpillar into the butterfly, right? I mean, that's a great analogy. So, well, you are giving birth to a new CD. Woo! Thank you for the segue. I really appreciate it.
That was real fun.
It's called Imagine Paradise. The entire CD will be launched this June, right in time for,
June
for Pride, which is great. Mm-hmm. This is really interesting because you got by with a little help from your friends. This Kickstarter campaign for this CD was kind of legendary. It was more than a year ago. And did I read somewhere that it was like the fastest or the third top
fan-funded music campaign, according to Billboard magazine, in August 2011. So I'm sure someone's exceeded
that by
now.
Well, nowadays, more people have found out about Kickstarter. But what was the idea for Imagine Paradise for you as a CD, and you know, why did you reach out to your friends beyond the was it just the obvious, you know, for monetarily for you to own it and for you to have this be yours and independently produce it? Or
I was talking to a friend of mine while I was still doing Million Dollar Quartet in New York City, and I was telling him how difficult it is really to run a one-man business with like one other person always helping you. Forever I had the amazing Rich Overton helping me, and now I'm blessed to have you know, Evan Warner over at Vision 9 Records, who is helping me a lot too. But it's like 80% PR and 20% music, and that doesn't get me off. And after, you know, looking at like finishing my fifth album, I was talking to a friend of mine. I said, I don't know that I want to go through that again. I don't know that I have it in me if I can't find a team that's going to step up and support what I'm doing. He says, why don't you let your fans decide? Just don't make that decision. Why don't you think about throwing a Kickstarter campaign together? And I acquiesced. I got with a girlfriend of mine. We thought of some fun incentives. One of them being that if you hit a certain price point, then there will be a song on the album that is a custom-written, personalized theme song for you regarding whatever you and I want to talk about. I'd get on the phone with them, and they would tell me what's going on in their life, and we would gear the song towards them. It turns out that all 12 songs are that.
So this is really a community album.
It is a community
album. Love letter for your fans.
Yes, it is.
How cute. Well, why the title Imagine Paradise?
Because paradise is yours to the degree that you can imagine it. And that's where I have been in my life, of realizing that the power of my own belief system, you know, creates the power of my life. If it's limited, then my experiences are limited. And if I push on the walls of those limiting belief systems and I begin to allow for more good to come into my life, well, lo and behold, it does. And I didn't want to get, you know, too spiritualized and preachy about the album, what I wanted to do is, I felt like it was my responsibility to take the stories of these fans or friends, I call them friends really because I've gotten to know them so well, and find a positive answer to what their story is. It's my responsibility to do that.
Oh, amazing. So the first single, you're releasing a single as you're heading out on this flying solo tour, which we're going to start talking about, but the first single is So Much Better, which is coming out this month of February.
February 16th.
So can you just give us a little insight into, you know, So Much Better and the conversation with the friend fan and kind of how that came about?
So Much Better actually was written for a wonderful guy that I've gotten to know in Nashville, Tennessee. His name is David McCormick. And he was so generous. He was the only backer that didn't want to have that conversation, really. And he was like, oh, don't do a song for me. Just, you know, let me be a part of it. And so I actually sort of just tried to use my intuition to, you know, I know that he is a successful man and that he's a very hard worker and takes his work very seriously to heart. And I wanted to create a song that created the vibration of, you know, letting go of what you can't change, accepting the things, you know, that are here and the wisdom to know the difference in the two. And just sort of support him in his ever-going, fast-paced life. I don't even know yet that he has heard this song.
It's interesting because I have heard the song, or I heard a little sample of it. And It feels like a bit of a new direction for you. You know, when we were talking last time when you were on the show, and, you know, I know we featured, I think, Nothing at All. Nothing at All, right?
Yeah.
You know, that has that kind of gospel-y, heavy piano sound to it. You know, this is definitely not that song. I mean, this is kind of, what is the sound that...
I feel happier.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, and while gospel is the through line of all my albums, you'll still find songs on this new album, Imagine Paradise, that feel very gospel.
Yeah.
And actually, you're not so far removed from Nothing at All.
Yeah.
I wanted to find a lighter.
It's playful and almost clubby. I mean, I don't mean that in a way that's any way reduces it, that's reductive. It's a dance party song for Levi. And I thought that was kind of interesting and like, ooh, I'm so curious. Because, like, you know, I think that you have this sensitive, really soft side where I love the song I Should Go, which I know is on The Vampire Diaries. Mm-hmm. And I don't watch The Vampire Diaries, but have friends who do. But I know it was between like a really, you know, romantic moment. But that's just such a soft and tender Levi. Mm-hmm. Then we have to get this gospel Levi. And I kind of love that there's, you know, whether it's claiming kind of the sexuality or the club scene.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not the druggy club scene. It's like the Cher, you know, club
scene. Yeah.
You know? Cher farewell tour song, which I kind of dig.
I've always felt like I belonged in the 70s, you know? And it's like a late 70s, early 80s disco-infused R&B.
You and I are the same.
I just would have... there's something about that where the minorities came together, the black community, the gay community came together, and they began to experience their own ability to change the social consciousness.
I agree.
And I felt like that was also the spirit of my backers, because my backers are activists. Mm-hmm. They have a history themselves of making huge impacts on our community.
Yeah.
It's like I can't not do this album without embodying what that freedom was, what that empowerment was, and what better place embody that than the real disco, the back in the day
kind of
stuff.
Donna Summer or Sly Family Stone or Sylvester. Yeah. It feels very, I love it. And I was like, talk about pushing your walls out farther, you know, earlier. Yeah. I thought that was super, super fun. So do you enjoy the process of you're so charismatic, you're so easy just to chat with your fans, I know, and just to sit down at piano and play. But do you enjoy kind of the singularness of being in a studio and mm-hmm. being...
I'm actually much more of a loner than I am a social person.
Yeah.
I'm a Jekyll and Hyde in a way. Mm-hmm. In that I'm truly an isolationist.
Yeah.
And I could hermit myself for days on end and just work or write or play. And then there's that part of me that knows that in order to share this,
I have to
access another side of me that tries its hardest to, you know, remember every person I've come across and engage in an authentic way and put myself out there, because
I think that's a Southern thing.
It's a Southern thing
for certain people, because I think people have always seen me as highly social. It's like, no, I'm very good at being highly social, but what is my true self has taken me even just in the past number of years to kind of go, I actually really enjoy my company. I enjoy being alone. And I was kind of terrified because I didn't know what that would be like. But I would say, too, that I can be an isolationist who, you know, can work a room if I need to.
It's nice to find the balance, too.
It is. Yeah. It's nice to be able to do both, you know.
Yeah.
But that's interesting because some people, like, hate the studio, love performing live. So it's nice that you enjoy both, that they feel, I don't know, Jekyll and Hyde seems like a positive and a negative, but it feels kind of the two sides.
Yeah, what would be
a
good positive and a positive? Well, okay, yin and
yang.
The yin and the yang of it is a better way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, well, you will be playing live, and I'm assuming solo, since it's called the Flying Solo Tour.
Yes.
It's a little obvious in the title. And you're going to be launching this tour here. Just go ahead and plug it right now. We'll mention it again. But you're going to be kicking off the Flying Solo Tour here in Chicago on March 2nd at 8 o'clock at Davenport's. That's Davenport's Piano Bar and Cabaret. And we'll have that linked, but you can go to their website or give them a call to make reservations. And then you're going to be heading out to New York, back to your friends in New York City, you know, D.C., Raleigh, Knoxville, hanging around my folks and friends, Atlanta, Houston, mm-hmm. And working on dates after that. What are your goals on this tour?
My goal on this tour is to focus on upping my own musicianship. For me personally.
Yeah.
Because most of my touring has been just me and a piano.
Yep.
And while I am foreseeing a show post Imagine Paradise release that involves a wonderful DJ who I have met here in Chicago, that I will be playing with her, playing my stuff.
Fantastic.
And have it a very interactive, kind of more high energy experience, afternoon kind of tea dance-ish kind of experience. I really want to get to a place where, I mean, everything's been, it's good and solid, but I just really want to push myself further. I want to be able to find, like, I listened to this live album of Ben Folds, and he's just on that piano, and it's just like, I've gotten lazy. I've gotten comfortable, and I'm done being comfortable. I want to see what, how...
Willing to be uncomfortable, yeah. Levi, 2013.
Yeah.
That can be your t-shirt.
the tour shirt.
It only gets good when you're willing to be uncomfortable.
It's true.
Right?
I actually ideally would love to get to a place too, and this is something that I just won't jump into the water and do, but I think it's a great idea, and I think I could probably do it, is to have an audience member off the cuff give me a subject and write a song right on the spot there about it.
Well, you know, Ann Hampton Callaway does that. She does that, but she doesn't ask for the subject. She asks for like 7 words and she'll write them down and then she just starts playing. And she's been doing that for like decades, you know.
Oh my God.
But I think that'd be great to get a subject and to, you know, go through it and do it.
Wow.
I mean, that's exciting.
Yeah.
That's exciting. Kind of bring the quality of improvisation and, you know, that moment.
It's so scary to think
about. It's totally scary. I'd imagine. I mean, I can't. There's a musical in town now called, like, Best Musical, the Musical, and they do that. They improvise an entire musical, like 4 or 5
I've
actors.
Heard about that,
we should go
actually.
See it. Let's go see it.
Let's do it.
We'll have a date
totally
before you leave on your thing. I think it's opening before your gig, so we'll try to see it before you head out on the road. Mm-hmm. So people can find out where you're touring on your website,
yes,
for sure, levichrist.com, and we will have that linked in our show notes along with the davenportspianobar.com website. Do you think of... You've actually kind of answered this question, but, you know, I always ask, you know, what's in the fire? What seeds are kind of in the ground? But are you interested, do you think, after doing this tour of, like, I'd like to dive into a character? Are you enjoying not diving into a character and being in Levi's skin right now?
I'm constantly going out for stuff. And I think that makes it difficult in that I'm releasing a single and releasing an album and starting a tour and adding dates to it. And like, this year is not going to end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by the time the album comes out, the second single and the video and the promotion for that. And I'm really trying to reach out with Vision 9 Records to get to these radio stations, visit them, sit with them, let them, you know, play it acoustically and really support it in a way that I haven't been able to before. All while I'm going out every week for new stuff.
And
a reading for a week.
Yeah.
You know, I've got another reading coming up in New York. So it's really difficult to kind of keep those plates spinning. As far as music, I think that I'm probably going to try to do a very classy sounding piano vocal version of Imagine Paradise next year.
Oh, interesting.
To really
even
sort of,
like, just strip down.
Just completely strip down with just me and a piano and explore different arrangements that are completely different from the album. I think it's something that my fans and supporters have always enjoyed, that kind of acoustic experience.
So 2013, we've just flipped over into 2013. It looks like it's a big year on the forecast. If you had to give your friend Levi some well wishes launching out into this year, and some gems to hold on to, what would you say?
Don't take it so seriously. That's what I would say.
Don't take it so seriously.
Don't take it so seriously. It's not that big of a deal.
Well, we think it's a big deal that you've been on the show with us. And now that you're in our home, in our hometown, if you're not living in Chicago, I'm sorry, because Levi's here now. But if you are in another town listening to us, and I know many of you are, definitely go to levichrist.com. Get the new, sign up to get the, pre-order your CD or get your CD when it comes out in June. Listen to the new single and try to hop out and see him when he's on his flying solo tour, because it's probably heading to a city near you.
Yeah, so. All tour dates on the website.
Thanks, Levi.
Thank you.
Got something to say? Call us today. 312-21-BE-GAY. Well, everybody, go out and see Levi on his tour. Go in our show notes, levichrist.com, and find out all the information on how to get his CD, download his new single, and check out his show at Davenport's here in Chicago or coming to a city near you. Everybody stay warm. Have a great week. And we're going to be talking Oscars because it's the high holidays. Yes, it is the high holidays, Oscars. All right. Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast, queer and now.